This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay, great. We're going to dive right in. So I'll introduce myself just a little bit more, and then we're going to go down the line with quick introductions from everyone up here, and then ask you all to talk to each other a little bit. So my name again is Lewis Raven Wallace. I'm here representing Interrupting Criminalization, which is a national, a national organization that works to end the criminalization of women and girls and trans people of color. I'm the abolition journalism fellow there. So my role is supporting journalists and media makers, both on the kind of working in journalism side and on the working in activism side, to get our stories out, to get movement stories out, and to get stories about transformative justice and community-led safety into the world, as well as to hold the journalism industry and field accountable for all of the problematic coverage of crime and safety. So that's what I do. I also have a book and a podcast called The View from Somewhere that's about undoing the myth of objectivity in journalism and how objectivity has been kind of a wedge and a way to gatekeep the voices of marginalized and oppressed people. So that may come up today, but we're going to kind of start this conversation, I think, from a little bit of an assumption of we're not talking about traditional objective journalism here today. We're talking about movement media and how we can build a stronger movement media infrastructure. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and start introducing our lovely panelists. I'll start with Clarissa Brooks at the very other end. Clarissa Brooks is a friend, has long been a rising movement journalist and working in a lot of different parts of the field, and is now the editor-in-chief at The Forge, which is sponsoring today's panel. So Clarissa, I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'll ask each of you after I introduce you to take like a minute or less to just say what's on your mind in terms of movement media. I want this to be a really present in the moment discussion, so that will hopefully shape what kind of discussion we have with everybody later in the session.
Cool. Hey y'all, I'm Clarissa, the editor-in-chief at The Forge, which is a movement strategy outlet by organizers for organizers. We're on all the places if you need to find us. And my thought today was actually around, I have a genuine, really deep-seated dislike of broadcast journalists in general. And I think with this most recent election cycle, I'm thinking about how broadcast journalism has normatively been a part of building like media conservatism, and just thinking about how as they integrate more like black women speakers and political analysts on cable TV, it's getting worser and worser. So that's my gripe today, and I'll pass it.
Thank you, Clarissa. So we didn't have a chance to update this in the program, but unfortunately Lex McMenamin from Teen Vogue was unable to join us here today for personal reasons. So we have in Lex's place Ryan Sorrell from the Kansas City Defender. Yay! And Ryan has done so much stuff. Their background includes working at one of the nation's most esteemed black think tanks, one of Chicago's top B2B tech PR agencies, a top three global PR firm, and founding Kansas City's largest black-led direct action group during the 2020 uprisings. Ryan has been a consultant with brands like Facebook, Samsung, Amazon, and Google. Ryan's a recipient of the Civil and Human Rights Award, recognized by the Urban League of Kansas City, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the NAACP. And he's also engaged in a number of public talks as a PIC complex abolitionist thinker, including speaking on NPR, PBS, a Kansas City Art Institute lecture, a lecture at the University of the Arts at London, the annual International Symposium on Digital Ethics for a Sustainable Society, and the T-Mobile Speaker Series. And we're really lucky to have Ryan here with us today to talk about grassroots local abolitionist media. So Ryan, what is on your mind in terms of movement media right now today?
Well, thank you, first off. Usually I leave out the whole Facebook thing.
Wrong crowd.
Just because, but it's all good. But I have, which I think we'll get into later, but just the role of media and what our role is. I feel very rooted in the tradition of the radical black press, and that's what our organization is also rooted in. And for us, what that means is that we don't even necessarily refer to ourselves as journalists. We are more so interested in providing necessary information for the survival and flourishing of black people in our city. And so I'm always thinking and looking back to what was the radical black press. Even organizations that aren't typically thought of as the black press, like the Black Panther Party or Muhammad Speaks, Malcolm X's publication. Constantly looking and studying those, Claudia Jones and other reporters from our history to learn and see how we should be functioning as media and not learning from organizations like the Society of Professional Journalists, the Associated Press, and these white imperialist fascist organizations as well.
Thank you, Ryan. So happy to be introducing Daniel Kisslinger. Daniel is a Chicago-based host and producer who creates dialogue-based media showcasing the stories, voices, and artworks of communities, challenging power, reconfiguring public life, and reimagining our world. He's a co-founder of Respire Production and Media, which you'll hear about today. It's a movement journalism and media hub. The co-creator of Ergo, a weekly podcast here in Chicago that reshapes culture for the more liberatory and creative. A twice Webby-nominated podcast producer, Daniel has been the executive producer of the Poetry Foundation's acclaimed VS podcast, editor of CTU Speaks, a podcast produced by the Chicago Teachers Union, and he also works as a consultant helping organizations like yours, individuals, and companies build humanizing subject-to-subject podcasts from scratch. So welcome, Daniel. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Louis. I'm thinking about, as people, you know, in this first day of folks gathering here, I'm thinking about what the last few weeks have been like in Chicago and the convenings that have happened and conventions that have happened in this city and what that has meant for how we've been able to gather and who's been gathering here. And so having kind of made it through that moment of whirlwind, I'm really grateful to have this space. One, just to be reminded of like the context of the work we do and all of y'all existing in this land and beyond, but also to just have a moment to evaluate, reflect, and learn from what's been happening, you know, over the last month in the streets here and beyond.
And last but not least, I'm so happy to introduce Damon Williams. Damon A. Williams is a movement builder, organizer, hip-hop performing artist, educator, and media maker from the South Side of Chicago. He's the co-founder of Respire Production and Media and the co-creator of Ergo, along with Daniel, a weekly podcast in Chicago that reshapes the culture of the city and beyond. He is the co-director of the Let Us Breathe Collective, an artistic activist organization birthed out of supply trips to support the Ferguson uprising in resistance to the murder of Mike Brown. So welcome, Damon, and what are you thinking about?
Hey, everybody. On a few levels, what I'm immediately thinking about, I'm self-conscious about these five people that can't see me from behind this podium, this like blind spot.
That's what he looks like.
No, sorry. I'll be a silly mostly. But I think what's coming for me is from a healthy place of self-criticism that mirrors experience and movement work. So very early on, 2014, 2015, a lot of direct action that were beautiful and powerful and ideologically aligned, but the way that they were designed, we realized we were building this beautiful movement, but we were moving without our people. And so similarly, as someone with Daniel, who's really focused on building an archive of building long-form content, and also centering the position of folks who need to go deeper in the liberatory space, folks who have agreement, have alignment, how do we build depth? But within that, I recognize that, especially in the last 5 years, just like the technology of information is shifting and expanding in a way where we're moving without a lot of our people. And so like the language of content and content creator is something that like I've disparaged and I don't feel very comfortable with, and we kind of like put in this superficial box, but there are so many reachable people that are being flooded with so much information, so much content that's really drowning out the life-saving critical things that folks like us are working to get to folks. And so what does it look like to value that space and transition to having more accessible pieces? And what does it look like from like a pedagogy teacher standpoint? How do we have scaffolding? How do we have different entry points for folks who, you know, aren't ready to do the deep dive?
Really appreciate that, and just hearing what's up for all of you. So how many people in here are media makers? Yeah, almost everyone, so I thought. That's great, and I hope that we will hear from you when we get to the Q&A and discussion more about what you're...
Oh.
Yeah, definitely. Everybody. I'm going to ask you all quickly to turn to a neighbor. If you can find somebody that you didn't come here with and meet and say hello, and just share your answer to the same question. What is on your mind right now when it comes to movement media? It's just a little warm up before we talk for a little while more and have a discussion. Go for it. You have 2 minutes. No. So as we launch into talking about movement media and movement journalism, I know there's all these kind of buzzwords and phrases, right? Like legacy media and solutions journalism and movement journalism. And I just want to say that we from the front of the room here, and speaking for myself, I don't take any kind of ownership, right, or sort of rigid definition of movement media or movement journalism. I see myself as participating in and hopefully contributing to a legacy of journalism that has supported movements over many decades and even hundreds of years. And so just really want to honor the many practices of that legacy that are in this room, that are in this city, one of the homes of Ida B. Wells, who's one of our greatest movement media, movement journalism inspirations, and also honoring how many movement journalists we're seeing right now being targeted in really violent ways for participating in that legacy and in that form of action, particularly on a daily basis in Palestine. So just kind of grounding us in being part of, and again, hopefully contributing to a legacy that we carry forward, and that today's conversation, my hope, will be a part of making the connections that allow us to continue to do that. So we're gonna start with a question for Clarissa. Who's worked on kind of all sides of this, working within so-called legacy media organizations, building movement-driven alternatives, now working as an editor-in-chief at The Forge, which is a movement strategy outlet. Clarissa, can you define movement journalism for us and talk a little bit about what the most urgent obstacles are that movement journalists are dealing with right now?
Yeah, I can. So I'm answering... I feel like we practiced before this.
Like you should never ask a yes or no question. Right. It's like journalism 101.
So this definition is kind of collectively gathered. I was a fellow at Press On, which is a collective of movement journalists in the South. I'm from North Carolina. It's my whole personality, so that's important to know. Movement journalism is journalism in service of liberation. So that means folks working collectively with community that supports people's autonomy, self-respect, and communal stories. And so that often means for journalists making sure that your sources, making sure that the stories and the angles have a purpose and a goal, and that also they're rooted in community in a way of, hey, if I put out this story, am I in conversation with people? Am I articulating what's happening in a way that feels genuine and authentic to people's experiences, especially the movements that we're fostering? Yeah, so that's movement journalism. I feel like the biggest obstacle folks are facing, and I'll say more as like someone who's growing into leadership in movement journalism, is really like funds and resources to do the work that we do. Like, you know, the mass collective of journalists are not, they would say that they don't have a political lens, even though they are taught and trained in the world of objectivity, in the world of neutrality, and in the world of making journalism in service to the state. But for us, it is just harder to say, I actually want to do something different, and I actually want to make work that calls a thing and is honest about that. And that often means funding has to look differently, hiring has to look differently, stories have to be written and fact-checked in a very different way. And so yeah, that's our biggest obstacle, especially as media as a whole is also being kind of stripped and eaten apart. We've seen huge layoffs over the past 4 years since the pandemic. And so it's hard to just keep people in journalism in general, let alone politicizing those journalists that are left to be a part of our work too. So it's tough out here.
So Damon and Daniel and Ryan have all been part of, as you heard, founding and creating movement media outlets and alternatives. Damon, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about what is the strategic purpose of movement media? Like, why movement media? Why now? What do you see outlets like yours as doing that legacy media can't do?
It's a really expansive question, so I'll try to hone in on a few, but I think as we are in conversation, more will arise. Kind of going off my first answer about like the larger society, I think we have to recognize that like all people in our society at large have been conditioned through capitalist and state-based media. And the intention and function of that apparatus is to mold people into passive consumers. So consumers of material goods, but also consumers of information. And so I think the biggest strategic intervention of movement media is it is designed and is communication and information to activate folks into participation, which is a very different mode of communication, a very different type of storytelling, the type of space, the type of analysis. It's not about sit here and feel good or agree or just get our snaps on, but snaps are encouraged here. it is how do we activate folks, and particularly folks who may not have had access to the rally, to the protest, to the campaign, to the organization, to the coalition without a midpoint. And the word media, just to break it down, is the plural of medium. So it just means to be in the middle. So what are we in the middle of, and what conversation are we trying to facilitate? And I think the first one is show up, participate. I had a little list in my head. I got excited about that one. Secondly, I think it is also really important, you know, the cliche of our job is to make the revolution irresistible. I think it's also really important to make it legible. And so for folks who are active and participating, you know, I'm 10 years into these spaces, and I'm still amazed by how vast and how much work is being done that I've never even heard of. And so for people who are just showing up and see themselves as, you know, going up against the most violent institutions in the world, that's really intimidating and can be really isolating, especially if you're not in a major media hub like Chicago is. Chicago is actually a very media-rich space, I think, in more rural spaces in the South, to where there's a wider sprawl, to see that you are not alone. Or for folks in Durham to know that there are folks in Seattle that are doing the same thing and speaking the same language. Because that capitalist media infrastructure, again, has worked really hard to marginalize us, to make us, all of our ideas are unelectable, we're the fringe, we're too radical, this is something to not be taken seriously. And so if we're all getting that same information, not knowing that we exist can really injure us. And then, you know, popular education and reflection. It's really the same intention of what organizing is. How do we create a narrative? How do we move people? How do we learn? How do we reflect? And so, you know, whether it's the Treatment Not Trauma campaign in Chicago, which won, or the Bring Chicago Home campaign in Chicago, which did not win, what do we learn about the machinations of organizing? Because so much also, I think, of not just capitalist media, left media is still about the results of institutional power. So even if it's critical of militarism, it's about what the Pentagon did today, as opposed to what did dissenters do today, right? And so, like, I think flipping the lens of who we're looking at and what the story is one of the greatest interventions that we don't have to focus on the institutions. We can actually make the grassroots a tangible, concrete thing that then people can interact with through us as a medium.
And just to follow on that, we'll get a little bit more granular from you, Daniel, about what Ergo and Respair Media specifically are trying to do. Like, why did you create those organizations, and what gap is that filling, or how is it supporting movement infrastructure more broadly?
For sure. So it actually comes out of a word that you said, or that's been said actually a couple times, this word contribution. The umbrella organization Respair Production and Media was launched in 2023, but we've been doing this living archive building, documentation, media making since 2015 together. And it came from seeing this, like, what to us with our limited but still like thoughtful historical lens felt like the significant overlap and intersection of the people building brilliant, engaging culture work were also connected to or were the same people who are engaging in direct action. And that was having like incredible effects on multiple levels. One, there was art that was being made that was reaching people and doing that work that Dame's talking of, bringing people into movement in a way that a lot of times is aspirational but was actually working. Two, the political formations being built in the early years and early days of the movement for Black Lives were like thoughtful, questioning, dynamic. And then we were seeing that like the conversations happening at this intersection, if you were in the room, you could feel the electricity. And we were both fortunate, privileged, had the access to those rooms. But we knew that if you weren't in that room, you couldn't see that. And what was happening in both of those spaces was going to get filtered through corporate media. And so this is the same time that, you know, this like dichotomy of drill music and the artists who we knew coming up in Chicago was like not the end story on the nightly news, was like dominating national news. And at the same time that we were seeing like this illegibility or intentional illegibility around demands coming out of Ferguson, around what was going to happen in the next chapters of that. And so what we wanted to do was very simple, was create a space that did three things. One, gave the people who are participants an opportunity to reflect, evaluate, and be celebrated. Two, provide an entry point for people in Chicago or beyond who were like, I'm interested, I keep hearing about what's happening here, I want to know where to start. Here's an entry point to know. If you listen to these, you know, the first 50 people, and you go to the things that they're posting, you will be related and in community with the work happening here. And then three, you know, as people who have, you know, always had a lens toward understanding the archive, we knew for us, we didn't have the archive needed to understand what had happened in other historical moments that felt exciting like this. Like Dame always talks about, you know, the figure of Fred Hampton looms so large. But if you compile all of the video of him on YouTube actually talking, it's a little under an hour. And so we wanted to make sure for the people that we were seeing and believing were going to have this transformative effect, not just in this moment, but historically, we wanted to make sure that there was at least an hour of them telling their story in their own words with thoughtful response that could then be accessible and be heard. And so that was the impetus from the beginning. And then our pedagogy and praxis emerged from doing this every week. Every week we went to the radio station, we interviewed someone, we posted it online, and we learned through doing the ways that you can build power through the ways that we interact with each other in dialogue. And that's informed everything we've made since, from the continuation of Ergo, to Help This Garden Grow, which is a show about environmental justice in Chicago and beyond, to 1 Million Experiments, which is a podcast and film documenting experiments and how we redefine and create safety in a world without police and prisons. And so that it all still comes from that same root of there's this remarkable potential happening in this room, and how do we contribute it? How do we contribute to it?
Yeah, and I just want to say, having just recently had the chance to see the 1 Million Experiments film, it's such a beautiful demonstration of that intersection of creating an archive and creating a political education or popular education tool while also telling the news, telling what's happening right now. So just a really brilliant piece of movement media that you all made. I'm very appreciative of. And speaking of brilliant movement media, we're going to talk about the Kansas City Defender now and a little bit more of that story from you, Ryan, of what led you to found a movement media outlet. What's the story behind that? And what is this practice of what you're calling abolition journalism look like for you all?
Yeah, sure. I wrote my remarks down because I just got done with an 8-hour car drive, so hopefully they're relatively coherent. But I would say, in terms of like why I co-founded the Kansas City Defender, at its core, it was feelings of powerlessness, feelings of visceral rage, and love for my community. I first started organizing when I was on campus here at Loyola Chicago in 2014, so I got to bear witness to some of the most radical revolutionary organizing by groups like We Charge Genocide and the Black Youth Project, which these were the years of the Buy Anita campaign, the lynching of Laquan McDonald, and the subsequent cover-up by Rahm Emanuel, calls for justice for Rokia Boyd and more. I was only on the outside looking in, but I met a lot of people involved in the work, and it was my point of radicalization, and not only rooted my understanding of organizing, but I also observed the ways that these organizations employ media as a radical organizing tool and a way to shift narrative. And from this point on, I began essentially having an obsession with studying media as a form of social control, as a colonial weapon, and imperialist bludgeon, one of the most potent mechanisms of the carceral constellation, and what I truly believe is a weapon of mass destruction. When the 2020 uprisings began, I quit my job, which was mentioned earlier, at a digital PR agency here in Chicago, and I moved back to Kansas City to become a full-time organizer for abolitionist direct action organization. I did that for about a year, and during that time, there was a black man in Kansas City named Malcolm Johnson who was murdered by the Kansas City Police Department in a gas station. And in the aftermath of that murder, every single white news outlet in the city reported verbatim what the police report had said, which was that he was armed and engaged in a shootout. And it wasn't until about a month and a half later that the workers of that gas station leaked surveillance footage, which showed not only was Malcolm unarmed, but that he was actually being pinned down by 3 to 4 police officers when one cop accidentally shot another cop and then shot Malcolm in the head from point blank range. And so, in other words, the police lied. They had exploited their relationship with the media to unquestioningly parrot their police reports and created a fabricated reality to engage in the cover-up. And I'm sure for everybody in here that is not something surprising, but that horrifying tragedy taught me that the capitalist, white, imperialist legacy media, while knowing or unknowing, were very much our adversary, and they were as complicit or even sometimes more complicit in the brutalization, criminalization, and genocides of oppressed people, both in my community and all the way to Palestine and Congo. I could not believe that these outlets made claims of so-called journalistic integrity or any moral position whatsoever. And I became determined to launch a radical youth-led outlet in our city, in Kansas City. I completely rejected the capitalist, again, white, imperialist, patriarchal, so-called norms of journalism. And in fact, I wanted no association with that word journalism whatsoever. This sentiment was amplified when I began researching the origins of the field and learned that the first newspaper in American history, the Boston Newsletter, built its business model around selling slave ads within its first month of inception. I learned that the only successful coup of a local government in American history was led by the editor-in-chief of a white newspaper during the 1898 Wilmington Race Massacre. Alternatively, I learned that the first black newspaper in American history, Freedom's Journal, made no false pretense of objectivity and was founded by abolitionists in a black church. I learned that the black press historically was, again, the second most influential institution in the black community behind the black church because of their physical presence and their community programs. And so all of this knowledge and reading and studying essentially that I had been doing is what inspired the creation and organizational structure of our organization, the Kansas City Defender, which I co-founded with a childhood friend of mine along with five high school students. Our organization is half editorial, which includes our social media platforms, our email newsletter, a podcast, while the other half of our organization is what we call community programs. Our community programs wing includes a mutual aid committee that has a free clothing program, a grocery buyout program, and we are actively running a campaign, which is run by some members who came with me from Kansas City. We're actively running a campaign to preserve Missouri's longest running black bookstore from being eradicated due to gentrification. We also have an arts and culture committee that has organized everything from basketball tournaments to hip hop concerts and open mic nights. And lastly, we have a political education committee that enables us to internally continuously sharpen our practices on both sides of the organization, as most of the people in our organization are directly out of high school or around college age. Lastly, for addressing the last part of the question, that for us, practicing abolition is about introducing, and I think as many others up here have said, about introducing and utilizing abolitionist language and framing in our storytelling and in our reporting, challenging carceral narratives and more. But for us, at its most basic level, it's rooted in the philosophical and ideological level and an understanding of the purpose and function of information and media. And so one of my favorite quotes that kind of describes that is from the revolutionary Palestinian freedom fighter, Basil al-Arraj, who is known as the educated martyr, who wrote, "Never spread the occupation's propaganda and do not contribute to instilling a sense of defeat. This must be focused on, never spread panic, be supportive of the resistance, and do not spread any news broadcast by the occupation. Forget about the ethics and impartiality of journalism. Just as the Zionist journalist is a fighter, so are you." And so finally, just as the role of the abolitionist organizer is not only to dismantle hegemonic structures, I view our role as abolitionist media makers to be imagining and giving language to new worldly possibilities and amplifying the work of others in our community who are doing the same.
Thank you so much for that, Ryan. I want to talk, just while we have this group of people here gathered who are practicing all of this, about accountability. When I worked in mainstream journalism, that term was usually used to describe what journalists would do to others, so holding people accountable. And there was less conversation about how are we accountable and who are we accountable to. And I think oftentimes the reason for that had to do with the structures we were working under. We were actually accountable to a corporate structure or to kind of a pre-existing infrastructure that had very little to do with either social justice or even our audiences. With that said, all of the work that you all are doing, there's a different kind of audience and group of people and movement that in theory you are accountable, we are accountable too. And when I say accountability, I don't mean the kind that's about punishment or shaming, right? But about how we actually take responsibility for our actions and conversation with our community and with our values. So how do you hold yourselves and the media that you make accountable to movements for liberation? What does that look like in practice? And I would love if you have examples of points of tension with that.
One, I just want to affirm again that framing of accountability, I think even within our spaces, we still shrink this notion to something that's reactive, and accountability is something that happens after harm, but the accountability to me is an acknowledgement of impact, and that can also be a proactive process. And so that's important, is a lot of our accountability is about our intentions, naming our values, and then interrogating when there is struggle. And how do we know that, like, we're not here to get to maximize listens or clicks or maximize profits, but to be in this relationship with, we actually even challenge the language of audience. Like we try to see the folks that engage our work as a base that we're building and organizing. So that's how I enter. One thing I think about specifically is, again, like the metrics are different when you're accountable to movement. So in 20, I'm thinking about the 18, you know what I'm talking about. In 2018, we did this series with Black Youth Project, the website, not Black Youth Project 100, but shout out. I got goosebumps you telling that story about 2014 to 16, by the way.
It was 19, sir.
19. And so we did this series with, you know, Black radical thinkers around the country, and we were culminating it with a live event and live recording with our homie and super star, Eve Ewing, Dr. Eve Ewing here from Chicago. Woo! And
excellent call and response.
We were doing it at a space that is loosely, because Kathy Cohen works with University of Chicago, we had access to a space that is an expansion of the University of Chicago's arts and public life thing. I'm gonna tell the truth. I was gonna try to be vague. And some young people, high school age students, came up to me at an event and like said they were like shocked or hurt to know that we were doing it there, because they see that as part of the displacement of their organization, Asada's Daughters, in Washington Park. And so we kind of like already had the contract, we had already like started advertising. It was not at the place where you can switch the venue. The venue was theoretically locked in, and if we were a traditional entity, we would say write a letter to the editor or, you know, do some type of gaslighting way or ignore it and just continue on with what made the most sense for us.
Or invited them to come up on stage or do a talk, which is some of the things we thought through.
And we had to sit really hard and like kind of last minute and inconveniently, but recognize that like, why do we have to make this choice? Is it more important to the however many RSVPs or to these folks that I'm in coalition with, right? And that we show up for each other in a different way. And so that is like a small pivot that like took some energy, took some expenditure.
What did we do, Damon?
We moved it to a different place is what we did.
It's important.
In Pilsen, yes. I'm sorry, I thought I said that already.
We just deliberated and ruminated.
Yeah. We moved it to a different place. They didn't have air conditioning in there. I sweated out my shirt, had to like change and everything. But something like
a
that
small
is,
price to
is the type of intention, framework, and who are we responsible to, and a 16-year-old girl who doesn't have institutional power in a traditional sense could easily be marginalized in that conversation. And we struggled for like, do we really have to do this? And the answer was, we are not who we say we are if we do not respond to this healthily. And that was a challenge and a moment of interrogation that I think was us moving with accountability.
Yeah, and really, to that last sentence, it wasn't just a like, we are not who people think we are. It's we are not who we say we are. Like, we can do this, but then we can't say that we're doing that. And so if we want to change the way we frame our work in relation to movement, like, there are many pathways to do that. But if we are going to make that claim, we have to embody that politic. And I think, so that in regard to like, kind of on the listener base end, I think that's a really good example. And then on the like collaborator end, you know, one of the things actually, Lewis, that you really helped us crystallize in your work is like the ways that this myth of objectivity isn't just like morals or work-wise problematic, but really what does it do around resources? And understanding that part of the impetus for that model or that myth is that it means that journalists don't have to share the resources with the people that they're taking and learning stories from. And so that became, as we built collaborations with movement organizations, movement figures like Cheryl Johnson around our project Help This Garden Grow, from the beginning it was like, we want to make sure to that contribution point, even if nobody hears this, the labor and the act of putting the energy of trusting us with your story should benefit the work of your organization. And you know, sometimes that benefit can look like a lot of different things. That was a large scale project, and it literally meant every penny that Damon and I made off doing that, we matched to the organization. And so then there's all the people that hear it and what that directs and the power that builds. But at minimum, if you are going to trust us with your time, your energy, your expertise, your story, we're going to make sure that that process, not just the product, benefits the work that you're doing.
And that's how we fundraised as well. So it wasn't just a choice that we made. When we went to foundations, when we went to institutions, we were naming, we view, one, their story as equity in this project, but also their participation in making it possible as labor. And therefore, as we are fundraising, every dollar of production that goes to Respair and Ergo, we are in the budget building it out in this proposal, matching it to people for community recovery.
Which made it a lot harder to fundraise.
That's made it harder
to that
fundraise.
Point. Like, then you got to raise twice as much money. And so it helped me understand why people don't make that choice beyond the moral questions or the questions of what does that do to the story. Like, it enables the hoarding of resources. Mm-hmm. And if you want to benefit people doing liberatory work, a huge role from that position in the middle is how do we serve as a conduit to move resources?
And it may not have transformed philanthropy, but it was an intentional intervention because we wanted them to know that this is the type of community model and relationship we want to see the world, you know, amplify.
Yeah, I can go briefly. So in what year is this? 2024. In 2022, I did an investigative piece on Oluwatoyin Salu for Harper's Bazaar. And so I spent probably 7 months working on that piece. And a lot of that was trying to talk to her family, trying to talk to her friends, getting to know like the Tallahassee like organizing community. And so I think movement journalism and accountability really brought me to this point where I was talking to sources about part of Oluwatoyin's life and having to, in my interview, say really explicitly to sources, like, this is a risk. You're putting your story into public view, you're putting your life into public view, and then also very specifically naming for me as a journalist, the relationship I have with people I'm interviewing for stories is critical, and so it doesn't stop with just, hey, we talk this week for 2 hours, and then you never hear from me. A lot of the friends that Oluwatoyin made all went to like FAMU, and I went to Spelman College, which is an HBCU. So I, very specifically for myself, was like connecting some of her closest friends to people I knew in Atlanta for jobs and stuff like that, and they've like stayed with me. But I think for me, because I didn't, as a freelance journalist, have the resources to do that, it was really critical for specifically sources that I knew were on the margins and giving me their time and their labor, like being like, the support I can give you outside of this has to be really clear and explicit. And also naming that, like, talking to a journalist about your story, especially something so sensitive and fragile, means something to me and means something to the story. And I think in practice, it also meant I had to kind of teach my editor that my sourcing had to look differently. So it's not just like hard interviews. I'm like Instagramming Toyin's cousin in London and being like, this screenshot of our conversation has to be like a point of information. And so because traditional journalism is like, it has to look a very explicit way, being clear that like, one, I'm talking to kids who are like 18, 19. They're like, I'm not getting on a Zoom call with you, but I can DM you on Instagram, right? But just stuff like that, like my sourcing had to look differently, my interviews had to look differently. And then there were also just parts of Toyin's identity that I didn't feel comfortable sharing just on a like survivor ethic tip of like, I was hearing about the church that she went to and the immigrant status of her family and her experiences where I was like, she's not here to tell me if she wants that said. And I also just felt like very spiritually tied to her story. So I was like, yeah, if it's not said, she's already had a lot. I'm not about to tell parts of it that she's not here to approve. And so really the survivor ethic and the movement journalism part were, I mean, those were kind of the hardest things for me to sit through to a point in the story where I was like, my editor was like, do you still want to do this? And I was like, I mean, it's really heavy, so I don't know. But I feel really proud of what was put out. But yeah, the sourcing, it for me, movement journalism has changed how I report, thankfully, because I feel like I actually am being a better human being, being a better community member, and taking very seriously what it means to be in community. And so opening myself up also to, if I get something wrong, I want to be in conversation about if it's wrong and making sure my editors know once a piece is live, it's still up for edits. If people are like, that's not my direct quote, that's not what I said, that's not what happened at that action. And my editors knowing that like that's the kind of journalist I am, it is still open for edits. And making sure that those edits happen and that like artists and organizers know that, hey, it's updated. It's in the thing, and doing that as best as I can. And if I can't, naming that like, hey, I can't get that edit done, but I'll make sure if we work together next time that it is, has been really critical.
I definitely resonate with all of that. I think especially on getting things wrong sometimes and like being able to admit it, particularly because like for us, our organization, we operate under the assumption that our police department lies like all the time. Like that's just how we operate. And so an example of a story that we reported on was in 2022 when a bishop, like a faith leader in Kansas City, reached out to our platform and said that a number of black women had been going missing off of this area called the Prospect Corridor, which is basically just where a lot of black people live pretty much. And multiple other people had reached out to us and said black women were going missing. That same faith leader told us he thought there was a possibility of a serial killer in the area. And we had spoken to numerous like people in the community who had also expressed the same sentiment. And for us, it's like we can't go to the police department. Like that would be the traditional journalistic method, basically, is to go to the police department, say, is this happening? They'll be like, yes or no. And that's just basically you take their word for it. Whereas for us, we can't do that. So we believe the people in the community. And we published like an initial story, basically, and said, these are the things that we are hearing from people in the community because we want people to be aware that this potential threat exists. We are publishing this. We will update as more information comes. We do not want to fearmonger. We said that explicitly, but we do think it's important to the safety of the people in our community for this information to be out. And that we published that on a Friday. By that Monday, our police department, because it just like spread a lot in our city, and so by that Monday, our police department came out and said, directly challenging our reporting and said, these are completely unfounded rumors and there's no basis to support these claims. And every single news outlet in the city, literally it once again, just took verbatim exactly what the police department said and more or less called us fake news. And this was at a time we were like, our organization was like maybe 1 year old. And so we had already been under like numerous attacks by the white like legacy media. And from my understanding, this was like their opportunity to put the nail in the coffin for us pretty much. And so all of the news outlets basically just parroted the police department. And so there was all of the news outlets were saying we were just like an illegitimate news source basically, and we were spreading harmful information. And so at the height of all of that criticism, we were having internal conversations and basically saying, are we going to believe what the police department is saying? Or who, in fact, are we accountable to? And we landed on, we are accountable to the black people in our community. And if we look at all the instances throughout history, our police department has lied time and time and time and time and time again. And so at the height of all of that, we published a open letter saying, we will not back down, black Kansas Cityans, we have y'all's back. And literally 3 weeks later, less than 3 weeks later, a black woman, a 21-year-old black woman, escaped from a basement, literal basement torture dungeon, where she had been held for over a month by a white man who they ended up finding. And when she escaped, she said that two of her friends had been also kidnapped by the same man and had been killed by the same man, and that she had been kidnapped in early September, which was at the exact same time that we made our initial reporting. And she said that she had been kidnapped off of Prospect Avenue, which was the exact same street that we had said in our initial reporting. And so even to this day, I'm still part of my question is, how do we verify information in situations like that without having to take the word, like what we call the police being the arbiters of truth, is how a lot of news outlets operate. And so how can we verify information in those types of situations? That's something I'm still struggling with, but there, once again, I think when we decide to do things differently from the traditional media, I think it just becomes very difficult to, the answers aren't as clear cut as they would be if you just took exactly what the police said at face value. So that's what I would say is one area that we continue to think about and work through.
I just have a follow-up question for you, which is when that woman was able to escape, how did the legacy media report on it, if at all?
They actually tried to make it seem like it was a completely disconnected incident. Exactly. And they said, because I actually, the crazy thing is, I was sitting at home, and so that 3-week period, I was like, I was almost afraid to publish anything, honestly, just because of like how much attacks we came under pretty much during that time period. And so when I saw the story that this woman, because the city that she had escaped from is called Excelsior Springs, which is literally 99% white. Black people, we don't even ever go out there. So I saw this story that said, woman escapes basement in Excelsior Springs. And I just kind of like see that. To me, I was just like, that's crazy. But I just kind of like keep going about my day. And then people start reaching out to me. And then the local news outlet, which is a family run news outlet in Excelsior Springs, reaches out to me because I have a relationship with a guy who is a family run newspaper. And we had already connected before. And he said, I think there's a connection between what just happened and the story that you all reported 3 weeks ago. And so it wasn't until then, and we started working with that family-run newspaper, and that was basically how we ended up making the connection. But the legacy media to this day, even the police department, still to this day, has never acknowledged the fact that they were wrong, that they lied, and yeah, it's. But that's, we don't expect anything different from them, honestly.
Thank you all so much for those, for digging into, I think, some of the more vulnerable and complex pieces of what this work looks like from the inside. I really, really appreciate those responses. And we're going to take a couple of minutes to let everyone kind of talk.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.